I'm very happy to welcome to our program Belinda Rodriguez. She's a national training director with the U.S. Student Association and is a co-founder of the Momentum Training Project. Also on the line with us is Ben Case, an organizer and PhD student at the University of Pittsburgh, and he's a co-founder of Think International and Human Security, as well as many other groups. Together, Belinda and Ben wrote the article titled Why Big NGOs Won't Lead the Fight on Climate Change that was originally published in the Roar online magazine. And Belinda and Ben, thank you for making time to come on the program tonight.
Great. Thank you so much, Scott, for inviting us. We're really excited to be here, and I personally enjoyed hearing the earlier portion of the program because it ties to a lot of the things we're going to be talking about connected to the Paris negotiations.
And Ben, you're there as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's great. Well, I thought it was important to get you both on tonight because we've interviewed some folks from some of the major green organizations and climate change groups that you're critical of in this article. And I think a lot of the points that you raise are very important for our listeners to hear and understand. You really make the point that the big green environmental groups capitulated. Groups such as the Sierra Club, Avaz350.org, in acquiescing to the French government's ban on protests during the recently concluded UN climate talks in Paris. And the pretext for the cancellation of any form of dissent there was the November 13th terrorist attacks, which we touched on in our earlier interview. So there's a lot more to talk about tonight about this article, which has a lot of important content. But first of all, Belinda or Ben, I wanted to get your view on why you believe that the French government's closing down protest at the climate summit was really unjustified and inappropriate.
Well, I can start with that.
Okay, Ben.
Scott. So the French government, you know, in response to the terrorist attacks, happened in November, granted themselves emergency powers, pretty sweeping emergency powers, that greatly extended the abilities of the security apparatus and limited people's rights. And the justification for this was for the sake of public security. Right, because it was possible there'd be another terrorist attack or something like that. And of course, that's a laudable pursuit of a government to protect its citizens against a repeat terrorist attack. But of course, we've seen things like this in the past, right? The Patriot Act in the U.S. stands out as, I think, the best example after 9/11 of a law that the U.S. government passed that also granted sort of increased security powers. The Patriot Act is, you know, now pretty widely understood to have been, at least in large part, power grab by the security agencies. And movement groups, activists, protesters have spent a lot of time trying to push back after it was already passed. And so there's plenty of reason to believe from the get-go that this would have worked out the same way. One of the ways we can tell is the French government preemptively arresting dozens of activists before what was planned to be the climate march, the on November 29th, the one that we're focusing on here. You can also see, for the people who did turn out, the same government that claims to be, have the interest of its citizens in mind and trying to protect the public is the same government that was attacking and tear gassing protesters. We can see a real contradiction there between this rhetoric of protecting the public and the actions of the French police.
Well, thank you for that. Belinda, I wanted to get your comments on the same topic, but maybe you could also include your views on the strengths and weaknesses of the final climate accord that was agreed to by 195 nations in Paris, to really discuss the shortcomings you saw there.
Totally. So I guess I want to back up a little bit and put this particular negotiation in context a little bit. So we knew that the COP21 negotiations were going to be really, really important. And since the last round of negotiations ended last year, there's been a significant amount of buzz within the climate movement around the gravity of the COP21 negotiations in Paris and the necessity to do something really game-changing that could potentially affect the outcome of the negotiations. And if, you know, it didn't affect the outcome of the negotiations, at least use the negotiations as a trigger event to sort of build the movement to this, like, critical mass of awareness. And so these negotiations were really significant because a lot of groups were saying that they sort of represented our last chance to pressure governments to make meaningful commitments to reduce emissions before the agreements would be revisited in 2020. So the agreements that were established at this negotiations will not be revisited again until 2020. And we have very similar outcome compared to a lot of other negotiations. Some prominent voices, including Naomi Klein, have even said that these negotiations roll back on a lot of previous negotiations. We have a non-binding agreement to keep temperature rise below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees Celsius, but it's based on voluntary pledges. And we see that the voluntary pledges that heads of state agreed to actually will lead to somewhere between 2.7 to 3.7 degrees Celsius of warming, so far above the threshold that most people have recognized as quote-unquote safe. So they're really just not exactly the outcome we wanted to see with this negotiation, and, you know, different voices saying that in, you know, a lot of ways they're less comprehensive than previous negotiations, and certainly continuing this trend of being based on voluntary non-binding commitments.
So to take it to, I think you're really a more general critique of the big environmental groups, the NGOs that you discuss in the article, it's their capitulation on the ban on the protests in Paris, I believe, is really what you interpret as a symptom of a larger problem with these big groups, that they are not making the urgent demands that need to be put forth to governments around the world, and they're really not fulfilling their obligation to push as hard as they can to go beyond these voluntary pledges and this non-binding commitment that was made in Paris that doesn't get the world where it needs to go in terms of limiting carbon emissions. So I would ask you, Belinda, maybe to take off on where you left there. What is it that you think the NGOs could and should do that they're not doing now? And maybe you can talk about some of the grassroots organizations that engage regularly in nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action. And what, if any, dialogue is taking place between these groups with maybe a more urgent agenda than that of the NGOs?
Totally. So in terms of what I think the movement as a whole, you know, including grassroots groups, including big NGOs, could and should do, I think the two important pieces are using events like the Paris negotiations to polarize the public around climate change so that the general public understands the entities that are sort of impeding progress, whether it's, you know, through their, you know, active things that they're doing, like the fossil fuel industry, or, you know, through their inaction, like we see with the heads of state who come together for these negotiations. So I think that's one key piece, is using moments like this and many other moments to polarize the public, to really understand the crisis, understand the players involved, understand the power dynamics around who is actively impeding progress, and then to build to build popular support for solutions that that will help us transition to a green energy economy that is democratically controlled, that serves communities, that builds equity. And I would say the second important piece is to, on a broad scale, to challenge the power structures that are impeding progress, and to do that in a really, really consistent way where, the movement is, getting a sense that, that we can't just win by, creating a very big march, and claiming big numbers, but to also popularize the idea that we need to resist against these entrenched power structures, and actively try to shift who's in control of making these decisions. And then, does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, that was great. I wanted to also find out, Ben, maybe you can address this. Is there any kind of dialogue going on between the big NGOs, the big green environmental groups that we all know their names? Is there any dialogue going on between the grassroots smaller groups engaged in direct action that were quite disappointed, if not outright angry about the way groups like the Sierra Club and the NRDC and 350.org behaved in Paris?
I think actually Belinda would be better to address that question,
yes.
But first,
sure.
If I could just actually follow up on what she was just saying. The Conference of the Parties is a UN-based gathering, right, that began in the 1990s, and based on the sort of international institutions that exist, it has no teeth. So even leading into this negotiation, even with the most optimistic views, the outcome was always going to be essentially non-binding. So it was always going to essentially fall short of what we need. And so it was a real opportunity for social movements to show up and point out the discrepancy between the type of change that the power structures that exist can offer and the type of change that that the world needs. And so from a social movement's perspective, announcing that the march would be canceled, which is what we're critiquing in the article, that several large organizations sent out an email, the police in Paris revoked the permit for the march, and a number of large organizations sent out an email saying the march was canceled. And so from a strategic perspective, this was a huge mistake. As Belinda said, social movements win by polarizing public opinion and leveraging people power. Corporations and governments, as we know, rely on the active support of the public. And we challenge that by withdrawing our support, which we can do in a number of different ways. But all of those ways involve confrontation. They involve confronting power sources in one way or another. And when the police tell us to back down, and we do, we lose momentum and we make future confrontations more difficult. Research and experience tells us that the single most important factor in social movement wins is participation. So when governments ban protests and threaten protesters and invoke terrorism, they're trying to sow a climate of fear and reduce participation. And so it's our responsibility as organizers to fight back against this, especially in this case, as an opportunity to connect a number of different struggles. As we mentioned, the previous speaker was talking about the Islamophobia, and this is a major issue in Europe at the moment, as well as, xenophobia and the demonization of immigrants and refugees. And this is a real opportunity to connect all of those things. So I just wanted to follow up on Belinda's last point, but I think she would be better at addressing what you were asking.
Yeah, just it may be an important point, but we want to save some time for some of the other topics that you addressed in your article. But Belinda, is there any kind of dialogue going on between these groups with differing points of view here?
Yeah, totally. So since we published our article, we've learned a lot more about the specifics about how exactly the decision was made and additional lessons that we can learn from that moment. So we now understand that the decision came out of the Coalition Climat, which was sort of a big tent coalition of 130-plus French NGOs and labor unions and faith-based groups. And it was So it was primarily French groups like that, and then as well as 350 and Avaz. Those two groups were also part of this coalition and were that was sort of the space that was formally organizing the march, although there were many other groups and organizations and delegations that were planning to mobilize around it. Those were the people that ultimately had the decision-making power over, you know, whether the march would proceed or not. And it's a really interesting moment to reflect on, thinking about these dynamics between the grassroots groups and NGOs, because we've seen in the climate movement groups use this repeated strategy of building big tent coalitions like this to organize massive marches. For example, like the People's Climate March in New York last year and the more recent March for Jobs, Justice, and Climate in Toronto. And coming out of all of those different marches, a lot of organizers have been reflecting on the limitations of organizing big tent coalitions like that, where there's not necessarily alignment on strategy, alignment on, you know, sort of solutions and political orientation and other important points of alignment. And leading up to the Paris March, an organizer from 350, actually, a person named Cam Fenton, published a really excellent article in Waging Nonviolence in September, examining, you know, the limitations of this approach and actually encouraging us to learn from those limitations in the lead up to Paris, acknowledging that, you know, there was this big tent strategy being used to organize the Paris March. And the significant points that Cam made were that, for the purposes of organizing, you know, maybe a single isolated march that's not necessarily connected to an important decision-making space or a high-profile event, a big tent strategy like that is okay, and the challenges and limitations are not insurmountable, but that as a, and I'm paraphrasing here what this person said, but that as a long-term movement strategy, we need to have more space to work through conflict and disagreements around strategy as they arise, and that without this space, the big tent can stagnate rapidly and just amount to the lowest common denominator of agreement among the groups. We saw another piece published in Waging Nonviolence from an organizer with the Climate Games, which was a Paris-based civil disobedience platform that encouraged people to initiate their own decentralized actions. This organizer discussed similar dynamics that contributed to the breakdown of the November 29th Paris March. The organizer from the Climate Games cited that, you know, when labor unions within the Coalition Climat decided that they wanted to back out, it sort of that was kind of the stopping point where it didn't become possible anymore. And so I think that's really important to reflect on, is that, you know, there are the climate movement is old, it has roots, it has history, and correspondingly there are a lot of different groups that exist that have spent a long time thinking about, long-term strategies that can effectively challenge power and create the solutions that we need to achieve climate justice. And so just recognizing that, I think, you know, there should probably be more space, especially when, you know, connected to high-profile events like the climate negotiations, to instead of using these big tent coalitions to just produce numbers, to instead do more intentional coalition building with groups who have alignment already on, you know, these important strategic and principled issues, so that we don't fall victim to, you know, in moments of crisis, just, you know, being victim to sort of the lowest common denominator. And so I think that's important to reflect on, because, you know, with the People's Climate March in New York, the other march in Toronto, and now in Paris, we're seeing the same dynamics play out. And so it's something that there's limitations here that we can anticipate playing out again and again and again. And because of that, you know, I think it's important to really think about how, in Paris, we saw these dynamics play out with really devastating consequences, because the march was not, just sort of a disconnected event. It was attached to, you know, to something very real that had a lot of urgency that was happening. And I feel that, by taking that approach of, organizing a very big tent coalition that was not very intentional, organizers sort of, you know, set themselves up for failure, because the coalition was not able to adapt in a moment of crisis, and that, you know, instead, if there had been a more intentional effort to strategize around these negotiations with groups who were in alignment, that the outcome would have been much better. I think it's also significant to note that the Coalition Climat, which was, like I said, the primary organizing space attached to the march, only with the exception of Avaz and 350, it only included French groups. It did not include many other groups and delegations that came from all over the world to influence, you know, the outcome of these negotiations, and certainly does not reflect you know, the huge, beautiful movement that, you know, is organizing the push for climate justice around the whole world. So that's one of the big reflections, I think, that's coming out, that's a little clearer now, now that we understand exactly how the decision was made and the space that it came out of.
Well, we're going to have to continue this conversation another time. There's lots more in this article I'd love to get to about economic system change and a lot of essential issues. You know, we're experiencing, I think, the hottest year on record on planet Earth in 2015. And here in the Northeast, we're scheduled to have 70 degrees here on Christmas Eve. Some unusual weather, and there's a reason for it, underscoring really the urgency of the issue to address, all of us, to address climate change. And while we just have a minute or two left, Belinda or Ben, I would ask you to provide our listeners some resources, maybe the place where they can find your article on the Internet, as well as any organizations you want to mention here that people can look up to get more perspectives on the urgent need to step it up in terms of fighting climate change and the causes for climate change.
For sure. So I would say in terms of, like, sources to read, different perspectives on these negotiations and just, you know, climate justice in general, I would point people over to the New Internationalist. It's a really fantastic online publication that's been providing excellent coverage of the Paris negotiations and creating a lot of space for a lot of dissenting voices to sort of, you know, address, you know, put their opinions forward and such. I'd also point to Waging Nonviolence. That's where two of the articles that I cited came from. They've also been providing really, really excellent coverage of the Paris negotiations and highlighting different perspectives. And then I guess the last group that I would want to highlight is the Climate Justice Alliance and the associated It Takes Roots delegation, which was, I think, a really strong example of the intentional kind of coalition that I cited that does have alignment, that does have strategic unity, because I see them as a just really impressive example of, you know, a big coalition of groups that is doing that work to be intentional about their strategy, about their messaging. And one of the groups who really embodied an example of how consistently throughout the negotiations of how our movement could have responded in a different way that could build solidarity while refusing to capitulate to the French government and sort of push the envelope. The Climate Justice Alliance is a coalition or a network of 35-plus grassroots environmental justice groups, I think mostly in the United States, but I know that the It Takes Roots delegation had delegates who were coming from international groups, from groups around the globe as well. So, yeah, I would point to them, point to the new internationalists, and point to Waging Nonviolence.
All right. Well, Belinda, thank you so much. We're over time here, and we'll make another date to explore these issues further. But I want to thank you, Belinda, Belinda Rodriguez, as well as Ben Case, for joining us tonight. And again, the article is Why Big NGOs Won't Lead the Fight on Climate Change, with a perspective on what happened at the UN Paris Climate Summit and the protests that were canceled in the wake of the terrorist attacks there on November 13th, but a lot of other issues at play there, as was discussed tonight. Thank you both, and we'll leave it there, and we'll look forward to our next conversation.
Cool. Thank you so much, Scott.
Take care, Belinda. Thank you, Ben. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. And Yeah, Belinda Rodriguez and Ben Case. Again, their article is Why Big NGOs Won't Lead the Fight on Climate Change.